Selbstverständlich weiß jeder, dass ein Meter aus 100 Zentimetern besteht. Wir können uns auch noch ungefähr vorstellen, wie klein ein Millimeter ist, aber danach hört unsere Fantasie wahrscheinlich auf. Ein Nanometer ist für uns demnach auch nicht begreifbar. Er ist ein Milliardstel Meter. Kein Wunder also, dass sich die meisten Menschen auch nichts unter Nanotechnologie vorstellen können. Ihr wird eine rosige Zukunft versprochen, denn in immer mehr Bereichen hält sie Einzug. Für die Datenspeicherung ist sie wichtig, in der Umwelttechnologie wird sie eingesetzt, in Brennstoff- und Solarzellen, in der Medizin und vielen anderen. Der Vorteil ist die geringe Größe, aber genau da liegt auch die Gefahr. Ich habe mich mit Pat Mooney unterhalten, er ist kanadischer Wissenschaftler, 1985 hat er den alternativen Nobelpreis verliehen bekommen und er ist einer der größten Kritiker der Nanotechnologie. Seine These ist, dass die größte Bedrohung unserer Zeit von diesen winzigen Strukturen ausgeht. Dazu hat er auch gerade ein neues Buch verfasst. Es trägt den Titel Next Bang. Zu Beginn des Gesprächs, welches wir auf englischer Sprache führten, wollte ich von ihm wissen, auf welchen Bang wir uns denn einstellen müssen.
Well, there's several bangs that come together, unfortunately. One of the big bang is the bang of technologies that are converging at the nanoscale, the scale of atoms and molecules, and that's both in living and non-living material. But there's a second bang that is a bang of the convergence, really, of major industrial interests with major governments. That's not exactly unique in history, but it's perhaps more pronounced now with the new technologies.
So what kind of technologies are these?
Nanotechnology, very much the case. The nanoscale activities there for manufacture. Secondly, synthetic biology, which is the living side of nanotechnology, really, the building of new life forms from the bottom up. And thirdly, geoengineering, the ability to actually geoengineer planetary systems. So that we can, in theory, escape climate change.
But the industry and some governments tell us nanotechnology or geoengineering are the best things for our future. Why do you have an opposite opinion?
Well, they don't know that. They have no clue, in fact. In the case of nanotechnology, here we have several thousand products that are in the marketplace today, and yet there's not even a scientific definition of nanotechnology. We have no regulations. In Germany, there really are no regulations whatsoever, nor in my country, Canada, to control nanotechnology products that we're using in our foods, in our fields, as pesticides, sunscreens, as cosmetics, as clothing materials. They're there now, and yet we don't even know that they are there, and we don't have a way of regulating their safety.
So what can really happen to us? Why are these technologies so dangerous in your point of view?
Well, some of them can be beneficial, at least in the case of nanotechnology. There are certainly positive possibilities, but we need to know what we're getting ourselves into before we start down that path. At the nanoscale, you can have materials that you're putting on your skin every day that can actually pass through your skin, pass into your organs, pass through the blood-brain barrier, pass through the placenta, and yet they're not regulated? That doesn't make any sense to me.
So, but what really can happen to me when these nanotechnology particles are in my body? Do you have an idea what happens to me?
Well, we know what happens when asbestos enters your body, and nanoparticles of carbon at the same size actually could act somewhat like asbestos. I think history tells us that we should be a bit more cautious about these things, and certainly there's no logical reason to put them into products where there's really no particular benefit to them, like cosmetics, until we know that they are safe. But frankly, that's a small part of it. The real question is who's going to own and control nanotechnology? Who's going to make the decisions about nature at the nanoscale and have the patents over that kind of nature? And that control is highly centralized.
So is nanotechnology or geoengineering a bigger problem than the climate change?
Well, geoengineering is being presented as the solution to the climate change. Politicians who want to get reelected are talking about how society doesn't really need to do anything to change. Industry doesn't really need to transform itself. What we can do is produce some kind of technological fix, some silver bullet that will solve the problems for us. And they're saying, well, we've already geoengineered the climate into this crisis through the Industrial Revolution. Now we will geoengineer ourselves out of this crisis by blasting sulfates into the stratosphere to block sunlight or putting something on the surface of the ocean to soak up carbon dioxide. Don't worry, we'll take care of these problems for us. And I think that's silly. That's really dangerous. The idea that we can actually play with planetary systems or again, have some sort of quick fix to climate change is nonsense.
So did they really try that already? Or is this just ideas of governments, of the industry to solve these problems?
Well, in terms of ocean fertilization, or the idea that you can spread a coating on parts of the surface of the ocean to soak up carbon dioxide, that's been tried 13 times so far by governments, including the German government several times, in different experiments in the Southern Ocean as well as in the Atlantic and the Pacific. And none of the experiments so far have actually worked. The last one was in 2009. There is now a ban or a moratorium, more correctly, against ocean fertilization as a geoengineering experiment since 2 years ago. And we're hoping that that moratorium will stay in place through the United Nations. But there's other talk now, very active conversations going on. For example, this week, scientists will be meeting in Kiel, Germany, to talk about how to establish a governance mechanism for geoengineering around the world. As that meeting goes on, there's similar meetings taking place in London and Washington among scientific organizations and governments looking at, well, how can we go about geoengineering the stratosphere? How can we put dust into the stratosphere to block sunlight?
So what is really the effect on our global system? Do you have an idea what really will happen to our future?
No, but if last time you saw a volcano, you got a bit of a clue of that because it's basically the same thing. The idea is, again, blasting sulfates into the stratosphere that can stay aloft for about 2 years at a time at the nanoscale that would, again, lower temperatures because it's there. But we don't know what would happen exactly. We know, we have predictions that we would increase the number of deaths from respiratory diseases by about 60 or 70,000 people per year, and that's a conservative estimate. But we also have warnings that if, in fact, you do lower temperatures in the temperate zone, you would knock the Asian monsoon off course, which would cause perhaps flooding in Asia and famine in Africa. You know, we're messing with planetary systems that we don't understand. We caused a problem, which is climate change, because we didn't understand our environment. We can't solve that problem by playing more games with the planet without being very, very careful.
So what will the future look like? In your book, you name a few scenarios. Can you give us an example? What will our Earth look like in 30 years?
Well, there's no Armageddon. There's no disaster as such. We'd just be a downward trend in terms of world health, in terms of our longevity, in terms of the environment around us, in terms of the loss of biological diversity around us as well. It's not a happy scenario, but we can survive it. But there are alternatives. And the book tries to describe a series of other possibilities in terms of sort of community level networking around the world, where communities of interest can come together and work together to safeguard agriculture, so we have food security in the decades ahead. And even though there is climate change, there's strategies that can be used at the United Nations to coordinate activities in a way that would make us more effective in governance at the international level. There's strategies that can take place among civil society organizations around the world that I think would make quite a difference in terms of making the societies more aware of these issues and giving governments the chance to actually think more seriously about what other alternatives they have.
For me, it's really hard to imagine a man of your knowledge. How can you really live your happy life while you know about what is happening around you and what kind of danger is everywhere? Can you block your research results when you live your daily life?
Well, I have a defective gene called the optimism gene. And I honestly do think that people are pretty good. I think that we can do better. I think our governments are shortchanging civil society and society in general, that they don't think that we have the courage or the ability to understand what has to be done and the confidence to do the job that has to be done. I think we are prepared to change our lifestyles and do a better job. I do feel that. I think it's true. I see change all around me that is very encouraging.
There will be a big party in Bonn where they celebrate 30 years of the Right Livelihood Award. You received this award 25 years ago. How much did it change your life?
It was very, very helpful. It really did help get attention to the issues that I was really dealing with in those days, which is more related to seeds and genetic resources. And I got a lot of friends out of that. I was more than a party in Bonn. I think it's really a meeting of people who've got the award for the last 30 years who are going to be able to talk to each other and think ahead as to how we can perhaps take our pooled wisdom and experience and say, well, here's some directions we can move in. I certainly know that the people I've been talking to as we all get ready to go to Bonn are talking exactly the same way.
I wish you all the best and lots more awards and interesting and important ideas for new books and, of course, a lot of fun still in Bonn. And thank you very much for having time for us.
Thank you.
Das war Pat Mooney. Er hat im Jahr 1985 den alternativen Nobelpreis verliehen bekommen und wird ab heute mit dabei sein, wenn sich in Bonn einige seiner Kollegen treffen, um das 30-jährige Bestehen dieser Auszeichnung zu feiern.